Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Located in Central Florida, Reformation Bible College seeks to equip students in the knowledge of God and His holiness, that they may glorify and enjoy Him in any career they enter. The founder of RBC, Dr. R.C. Sproul, carefully designed the curriculum to provide students with a classical education that is distinctly Reformed. In addition to receiving a firm theological foundation in the Reformed tradition, students have the opportunity to grow as they know, serve, and worship the Lord together in community with like-minded believers. Whether attending a weekly chapel service, catching up with a neighbor in the on-campus residence hall, or meeting with a professor at the cafe, an RBC education provides students with plenty of opportunities to take the biblical truth learned in the classroom and put it into daily practice. Incoming students can win a full tuition scholarship for their first year of on-campus studies through RBC's annual essay contest. This year, students are invited to submit essays on themes related to the Apostles' Creed. Entries must be received by March 1st, 2024. So start writing today and enter to win at reformationbiblecollege.org/essay. If you'd like more information about RBC, visit reformationbiblecollege.org or send an email to admissions@reformationcollege.org. Hello, and welcome to Dwell, a Searcy Institute podcast for homeschool moms by homeschool moms. I'm Karen Kern, and I'm here today with my co-host, Renee Mathis. Hi, Renee.
Hey, Karen. It's good to see you. You came back from the Searcy conference.
Yeah, we were at a regional in Atlanta, and now we're back home and back at all the things, but it was good. And actually, today, we have a guest with us who was one of the speakers at the regional conference, and that is Greg Wilbur. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Karen. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thanks for being with us today. So by way of introduction, Greg is a founder of New College Franklin, a college that focuses on the classics and the seven liberal arts and the spiritual formation of their students. He is a master in music composition and is author of Glory and Honor, the Music and Legacy of Johann Sebastian Bach, and has writings in other places and other books. He is a composer, a speaker at classical conferences. As I said, he was just at our regional in Atlanta, and he was a winner a few years ago of the Paideia Prize. And he lives in Tennessee with his wife, Eleanor, and daughter, Sophia. And we're so glad that you're with us. Oh, I got that wrong?
Actually, reverse, but yeah. Oh. Wife, Sophie, daughter, Eleanor.
I don't know why I thought that. Why? Okay, to get it right. Wife, Sophia, and daughter, Eleanor. So thank you for being with us today. And just to jump right in with a question. Mm-hmm. Imagine that you're speaking to a young mom. Maybe she has younger kids, and she knows that music is important,
But she didn't really have a good background in music herself. She's not very knowledgeable about it. And she wants to offer something to her children that she didn't have. Where does music fit in the classical curriculum for her?
That's a great question. I think, there's two things. One, why I would say what I would say to the young mom, and then what I would say to the young mom. And starting with what I would say to the mom would be, fill your home with music. And I don't necessarily mean music appreciation or lessons necessarily right away, or some sort of historical curriculum or whatever, but just have music a part of your daily life. And part of that is almost kind of enculturation or narrative aspect of your family. Not just, well, I know that these, you know, works, Mozart, Bach, these are important, so I'm going to fill my home with these pieces. That's a part of it for sure. But it's also hymns. It's also chant, definitely folk songs. Being able to sing together or listen to music, or even associate different music with different different times of the year or different holidays. And just making that just a general part of what you do in the family. And so that the idea being, and the idea behind that being, a love of and a cultivation of those things which are beautiful. And the thought behind that would be, you know, with early Greek education, the idea of gymnastics and music. One was the training of the body with regards to the gymnastics, and music education in the muses, literally, is, you know, for the Greeks was history and poetry and dance and astronomy. And of course, music is part of that. But all those things were telling a story. You know, it was the enculturation aspect of, this is who we are. This is who we are as a people. These are the things that we love. These are the things that represent us. And so even, you know, part of that is, you know, what represents your family? What are the songs that represent your family that were important to your grandmother, you know, that your mom sang to you and that you're passing down to your own child? And those things, I think, over time, you know, develop a love for and an interest in what music is. So, and then you can talk about other further steps. But I think first of all, most of all, is just have music available.
Well, now it's so convenient thanks to things like Spotify, and, you know, right. we have this, not me personally, some that have Alexa. You can just tell Alexa to play Mozart or something. So, but the choices are almost overwhelming in that, because, like, you know, where do you start learning about classical music or appreciation? Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate your encouragement to just fill your home with music, and that's part of who your family is. That is encouraging. So we can do that. We can start.
Right. You can be singing too, right? Like,
yes.
For example, you know, my son-in-law, Alec, he has such a beautiful voice. And he just sings all the time, and he sings in, they sing in the car, and they sing in the house. And so my granddaughters, who are 4 and 6, they just sing all the time. And I know, because I know him and he likes to teach, he probably every now and again was particularly there. They sing the liturgy. So they sing the liturgy in the car. You know, he might say, oh, you got that note wrong. Let's redo that. But it's all very natural, and they love mm-hmm. it so much. They're just singing all the time.
Right. Well, yeah, and you know, there's something that, you know, literally resonates with order and the beauty of music, and so there's something that that we are attracted to that, and so being able to participate in that and without making it necessarily a study or a formal instruction, but by building up this repertoire, so that when you do have formal instruction, you have things to point to, mm. you know. And you can talk about how a melody goes up and how it goes down and where it moves and things like that. But that doesn't necessarily, especially with the early ages, that doesn't have to be a lesson, a very specific curriculum, but just begin to notice what you're listening to and being able to find words to talk about it, even if they're not the right, you know, quote, right musical terms. You can still identify the sense of, you know, does this piece of music come to a place of rest, or is it unfinished? you know, where does this feel like this needs to go? How do you kind of intuitively feel that? And that gives you a repertoire, not only of music, but of also ways to talk about it. So that when you do formalize some of that, I mean, the study of music, I mean, I tried to teach my daughter music when she was younger. And you have written notes on a page. We were working with piano. You have written notes on a page, and you've got the staffs on the page that go up and down, right? You've got notes that are up and down. But we're sitting in front of a piano in which the notes go, quote, up and down by going left or right, which is a different movement than what you're seeing on the page. Where do you put physically, you know, your fingers that are able to make those notes? And then what's on? So it's difficult. There's a bit of a disconnect between what are you seeing? What are you physically doing with your hands? What is this instrument in front of me, whether it's a string instrument or piano, et cetera, that, you know, ultimately, you know, something clicks and you realize that all of these things are speaking of the same idea. But I think especially for a young mind, there's a disconnect between what's going on the page and what's going on through your fingers and what you're hearing. And so if you can develop that sense of the oral aspect and the participatory aspect, then those other things make more sense. And then when those things click, it's like, oh, these are all connected. And I'm seeing, you know, this dot on the page represents this key on the piano, represents this sound. Then things begin to make a lot more sense. But that takes time. You feel like you're entering the same, you know, you're entering the same house from all different doors, and you're not even sure that it's the same house. Yeah, I think cats are like that. I've heard that cats don't know that if they go out one door, if they come in the other door, that they're in the same place. So it's you just kind of like, you know, you're trying to enter into the same space, but every door seems like a completely different house.
Mm. Oh, Greg, am I hearing you make an argument then that choral music or just singing is the best place to start because we all have a voice? And we can use it. And as Christian classical educators, I would say we're mostly going to church on Sunday, so we have a lot of chances to practice.
Right. Absolutely. And I think, and there's a way too. I mean, depending upon your tradition, your liturgy too. You know, is it possible to know what music is coming up that Sunday, so that you can even sing that in your home ahead of time? You know, what are the songs? What are the chants? What are the things which are a part of the culture and the nature of your church? So, you know, if you're in a hymn singing church or something, you know, what are the ones that you sing a lot? What are the things that mean a lot to the congregation? How can you, have that sense of identity, that church identity, as well as in your home, that these are the songs that we sing? And there is no substitute for being inside of a piece of music in terms of participating in it as opposed to listening to it. Being inside, you know, especially if there's opportunities for part singing with other people, that you recognize where your part fits in with other parts. And you don't just get that if you're just listening to it. But when you're having to fit your voice in with the other voices and see how they interplay, that gives you a whole different appreciation for, you know, in some ways too, the body of Christ, that we all have different voices, different parts to play, and the total is much greater than the sum of the parts when all those things come together.
It's a very it seems like a very organic way of nurturing your child's spiritual formation. You know, because all those songs, all that isn't just for church. You know, we bring that into our house, and it's a very simple and really easy way of bringing of what we do at home is the same as what we do at church, and we participate in both places.
Right, and there's not a disconnect. It's not this is what we sing on Sunday, and this is what we sing on other days. But this is part of our home, part of our family. There's other music that's a part of that as well. I think, you know, it's one of the things that hopefully helps too, in various, especially Protestant traditions, we've lost the we've lost the recognition of where particular types or places or where music should be. You know, we don't have the same communal settings, whether it was a pub or a coffee house or something, in which the community gathered and sang certain songs there, or songs within the home, or work songs, and here's liturgical songs. I mean, because we don't necessarily have those other venues, a lot of that music that we resonate with one way or other has been imported into church, because that's the only communal place we have for music. And we've lost that distinction of what is really liturgical. The aesthetic is for the purpose of worship, as opposed to music that has other purpose and other aesthetics, which are wonderful around the campfire or with, you know, your friends in some sort of informal setting, but maybe not necessarily appropriate for Sunday morning worship. And so, you know, cultivating all of those, but then also recognizing the distinction between where those various spheres of music fall, based, you know, a lot on the aesthetic intent as well.
Let's take a moment to jump in here with some information from our friends at St. Constantine College. Individual mentorship, Socratic discussion groups, courses based on primary texts, a rural campus, minutes from downtown Houston, St. Constantine College is a holistic institution committed to helping students flourish fully as scholars, citizens, and souls. St. Constantine College welcomes small cohorts to a big city and offers a world-class great text education at a low cost. To learn more, visit stconstantinecollege.org.
That's really a neat challenge, especially for our young moms and who have little kids, and thinking about what their homeschool community might be looking like, to find places to gather and sing songs with other families. That just like you just said, let's bring some. How can we bring some of that back? That's really beautiful. That to enjoy music outside of church, but to actually participate and right. You know, get those parents to dust off their guitars or whatever to play in college, and you know, have a little sing along maybe, and some good fellowship around that.
Well, when my mom and dad were in growing up and going to public school in the, when would that have been? Like the 50s, 40s, 50s, music was required. Everybody had to take music classes. This is public school. And so everybody learned to sing in some form or another. And it's fascinating to me, too, just over time. Like even when we have a choral service at church, you know, the people that are more likely to come are older folks and homeschool families that have more of an interest in music with regards to what they're teaching their own children. But there's a whole swath of folks who just don't have that experience or that understanding or that background, that the idea of going to a choral concert or service is not the same kind of priority, because there's a gap there from their own education. And that's really sad. I think that they're missing out on something just because it's not been regularized as a part of their own upbringing. And so that's part of the idea too. Like this is normal. You get together with people and you sing, and not just sing to yourself in your car or with whatever is currently playing through your earbuds, which nobody else can hear but you. You know, we've individualized music and taken away from it being a communal practice. And that's a significant loss. I mean, Bach would want to, in Leipzig, the place where he served the most, and that's where he taught and he was working with the churches there. There was a place called Zimmerman's Coffee House. And it was basically a coffee house and pub. There was a beer garden. And coffee was relatively new too. So, but it was a gathering place. That's where people went, gathered, met with one another, socialized, drank beer, drank coffee, etc. But there was a kind of in-house group of musicians that people would jump in and play whatever. And some of his compositions he wrote for this community gathering of musicians within the context of this gathering place. And that's a beautiful thing. And we don't really have anything that's analogous to that, which is really sad, I think.
It is sad. It's like one of the downsides of technology, because, you know, it used to be that all music that if you were hearing music, you were hearing it live. And right. So you were in the room with the musicians. And, you know, now, of course, it doesn't have to be like that. Everybody can be in the car with different ear pods on, listening to different music all by themselves. When we would take road trips, and, you know, we would have all the old, do you remember the We Sing cassette tapes?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So our kids grew up listening to those. And then when the older ones started to become teenagers, we didn't let them, nobody in the car was allowed to have their ear things in. And so everybody had to just be listening to the same thing. I'm sure that under their hoodies, sometimes they actually had some wired. But everybody was listening to the same thing in the car and often singing along to the mm-hmm. We Sing. But, you know, with the onset of technology, it like you said, a lot of the communal aspect of music is gone.
But yeah, the thing about what you just described is not only were they learning what they were hearing, they also, I'm pretty sure if you asked any of them, have a memory of that. That together in the car, they were listening to that over the years and singing together. I mean, that has become then a family memory. That's a part of your family culture because that's what you do. Now, so it was not just the music itself. I mean, you can tell a child to go listen to a list of music, but that's far different than saying, hey, let's go to a concert together or let's listen to this together. And your comment about you know, being in the same room as a musician is dead on too. It's a whole different experience when you see music being made as opposed to just hearing it. I mean, we can see the movement of the musician when you can see the anticipation of the start of a note, or when you see a singer breathe or choir when they breathe together. And yeah, you just can't capture that in the same way through a recording, whether it's it's a video or audio. And so that aspect of being there live to see it happen, I think is really significant in understanding music.
And I think that can encourage a love for it in children when they see that. Mm-hmm. Now when they see, oh, I could do that.
Yeah.
Well, when you see people enjoying what they're doing, you know, when you listen to something, you don't see them whether they're enjoying it or not, or whether it's just work or drudgery, you know. But when you see musicians playing together and you see the nonverbal communication between them and, you know, all those other things, those intangible elements, which are, you know, maybe even inaudible, but contribute so much to the sound, to the music itself.
Hmm. I would ask you a question, and this might seem like it doesn't apply to our moms with, you know, small young children, but in order to kind of give us that vision and help us look forward, you know, the trivium is followed by the quadrivium. And of mm-hmm. course, one of the arts of the quadrivium is harmony. And so you've already told us that, yes, we need to saturate our homes with music, even when our children are little. But as a classical educating mom, and I'm looking forward to, okay, high school or college, what part does the art of harmony play in classical education? Because it's up there with, you know, astronomy, and those are like the hard subjects. And it seems like we've all of a sudden taken a huge leap from folk songs to the art of harmony. So can you tell us how that fits in?
Right. Well, and one of the interesting things about the nine muses as well is that astronomy is one of those as well. So music as part of the education of the muses as a child versus astronomy as part of the quadrivium is kind of the same, I think the same kind of situation there. And I think part of it's a difference of kind. I think, like when I see astronomy in the with regards to gymnastics and music, I think that's the stories of the constellations, the mythology that goes along with the spheres, and it's once again it's the aspect of who we are. With the music at that level, here are the things that we love. Here's this training in beauty. Here's this training of the affections. When you move on, and then. From there too, I don't want to skip over this. Hopefully will lead to things like, well, direct conversation about music and music appreciation and aspects of music history that can be woven into all sorts of curricula and as you work through various years. with the quadrivium specifically, art of of harmony within the quadrivium sometimes is taken to be essentially music theory. I don't think that's the case. You are certainly dealing with the mathematical aspects. What music theory doesn't even typically deal with that, but you're dealing with the aspect of numbers and how numbers sound, and so you're dealing with relationships. But harmony in the quadrivial sense has applications to cosmic harmony, instrumental music, heard music, which we're most familiar with, but also the heart, you know, on a personal soul level. So, you know, when scripture talks about having a pure heart or an undivided heart, that's also harmony with regards to, you know, what's your schedule? What's your diet? What's your spiritual life? And then from the beyond that, are you living in harmony with the people in your home? Are you living in harmony with the people that you go to school with, that you go to work with? And so the example of that is what we've studied and what we've learned to love through the music that we've heard. We understand, hopefully, to some degree, what order is, what it's supposed to be like. And that gives us a love for an orderliness with regards to our soul, spiritual life, our relationships, the cosmic element, which is, you know, living harmoniously in our surroundings, living harmoniously with creation, living harmoniously with the cosmos, as exemplified by music. But it's not solely solely music itself. That kind of makes sense, I think. So it's the foundation for all of that. But the quadrivium itself, it starts with music as the foundation and the mathematical aspects of why music sounds the way it does. And so all of that listening, all that preparation feeds into that. But then it just goes far beyond that into a principle that connects all sorts of other aspects of life.
So if our children, as they grow up, if they choose to enjoy or listen to or participate in music that, I don't really know how to express it, so I'll just say is not harmonious, is more violent, or is, I don't want to sound judgy, so I won't. But like, we all know that like there's going to be music that if our kids listen to it, we're going to be distressed by the language in it, by the lack of harmony, by the lack of the expression of truth, goodness, and beauty. So it's kind of the opposite of what you're saying in terms of, you know, music, the harmony of music spreads out into our whole life. Well, the disharmony or the chaos can also do that. So, you know, what do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great question. And there are, I think our minds probably turn to like a specific genre or something, whether we're, you know, maybe somebody might be thinking about heavy metal or, you know, particular bands or so forth, or some sort of movement. I think there is just as much a potential. I mean, here's the premise too. If music is ordering, then it trains our affections. Mm-hmm. And so what we listen to is training our affections in some way and shaping us in some way. But I think it's also just as significant to talk about some of the 20th century, what would be considered classical music or art music, kind of that line of things, which is chaotic. Which is more noise than music, which is undermining principles of sound. That also is a disharmony. There is also music which is, I can't think of a good word for this right now, overly harmonious, from the sense that it's deadening. You know, that it actually moves us away from contemplation or thought and just kind of deadens the our senses, and that would be, you know, whether that's, you know, new age music or soundscapes or so forth. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to pick on particular genres, because I'm sure people can find examples in all of those that they say, well, this contradicts, and that's the thing, we can have those conversations. But so it's not so simple as to say this genre is inappropriate in one way or another, and there are some that lean more towards that. But the thing is that it's when your soul is being shaped, you're much more aware of those other influences. I had two examples spring to mind. I was teaching. I had a homeschool co-op that I started a number of years ago, before new college days. And one of the kids in the co-op was he was into some. I think it was heavy metal, basically. But he knew that when he listened to it, he was doing so to fuel anger. Mm. So he consciously knew what he was doing. So he was aware. And I, part of the co-op, I was having them listen to different pieces of music. And I at that particular time, for various reasons, I chose these loud, bombastic pieces that I thought might, you know, kind of resonate a bit, like Mars from The Planets, which is, you know, pretty driving and intense. But no matter what I played, no matter what I had listened to, his response was always, "That's so peaceful. That's so calm." And I'm thinking, this is like this torrential movement and of loud and, you know, contrast of, and but compared to what he was listening to, but he knew the difference, and he was, you know, could articulate that. So part of that may be willful, as opposed to in terms of that being kind of slipping into that for soul. Soul affecting aspects. Another one would be a student recently, because we talked about music, because we talked about how music worked, because I had him listen to other types of pieces, he could no longer, in good conscience, spiritually listen to some of the music that he had been listening to before. And so I didn't talk against that. I didn't teach against that. But by introducing other things, it made him reevaluate and realize the effect that other types of music was having on him. Mm-hmm. And so he began to adjust the things that he was listening to on his own. I think there's a sense too that, you know, it's not very helpful to just say to someone, stop this thing in your life, whether that's, you know, food, exercise, music, whatever, you know, this practice, you know, there needs to be some sort of movement towards replacement of. And so even the idea of like, okay, you're listening to this genre of this music, I don't really love that, but here's some other music, and let's listen to this as well. You know, let's expand this circle a bit. And I've seen it time and time again, when that circle gets expanded, that those things which are representations of a harmony and order begin to push out the other.
That makes sense.
It does.
I wanted to ask you about, so very basic, ages to start formal training. Because when I taught third grade, I had a lot of students in my classes who were just beginning piano. And it seemed to make sense, because that's also when they're learning to read. So that, or they know how to read, but mm-hmm. like, you know, it seems like maybe, I'm guessing here, for piano, it's good for children to have the skill of reading, interpreting signs. Mm-hmm. But I also seen my grandson learned violin before he could read. It just seems like so many kids in our local co-op, they all start with violin. Whereas when I was growing up, everybody started with piano. So right. I think it feels like violin maybe has a advantage for younger ones. Is that true?
Is that Suzuki method in terms of how they start violin?
I think it is, because I don't think right away they weren't really learning to read notes.
Right.
They were doing it by ear, and they were
right.
You know, and a child who has I don't know. I think Jeremiah, one of my grandsons, says he has a good ear, and he picked it up very quickly.
Well, and that kind of goes back to what I was saying too, in terms of learning to play or appreciate or participate in music without necessarily learning the notes first. So those can come later, but now you've got something to build it. Oh, this sound looks like this. But for a while, you're just playing with the sound. So I think probably violin has a number of advantages in the more recent days. I think it's probably less expensive than buying a piano. And people don't have as many pianos in their home or maintaining them as well. Violins can also come in various sizes. So obviously, especially with the younger ones, when you start them out. So you have a small violin that fits small hands. A piano keyboard is unforgiving in that regard. You know, it's hard, depending upon the size of your hand, your fingers, or your strength of your finger, you know, in terms of being able to stretch over the keys. You know, that has another thing. One thing about a violin also, which may have an advantage, and I'm a pianist, and so I'm not speaking against piano. I mean, I love piano. But one thing about violin as well is there's no fixed frets. And so, you know, to get the note, like you said, to have a good ear, you have to find the note on the string. And so at the same time, you're also training your ear to what is harmonious and what is not. And so you're, by the mere fact of not, hey, you need to adjust those notes one way or the other, but you know what the melody is supposed to sound like. And if you're trying to reproduce that melody, you're going to have to make those adjustments. And so you're subconsciously doing those things as well. So I think it probably cost is one thing. Classes, it's, you know, when you have a Suzuki class or a violin class, there's usually more people there. A piano is a very individual type of activity. It's a great skill to have. And you know, there's a good advantage there. Another thing too is recorders as well. I mean, that's a good place to start. I think part of the recorders have a poor reputation because there's been too many translucent pink versions out there, you know, plastic. Yeah. but you know, the recorder was a legitimate instrument. Yeah. Before before what we think of as the flute, the transverse flute. So, I mean, you can Google online, like a Vivaldi recorder concerto, and it's masterful. So it's a legit instrument. It just seems it's been, pink plastic hasn't done us any favor in that regard. But at the same time, I mean, if it's a pink or purple sparkly recorder that gets somebody to play, that's helpful too. And that's also a really easy entry point. But you know, it's the consistency too, and there's, you know, there's muscle memory involved. It's not just cognitive to all those things. So I think you're back to your point. The age is the cognitive, but it's also the muscle aspect as well, and even the size of hands and fingers.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Really helpful. Thank you. I feel like you've given us a wonderful vision for what our homes can sound like, which is a place we can all start to. How we can help our kids learn to even play music for themselves, and what to look forward to as they get older. So thank you, Greg, for being here. And we wish you the best in all your college endeavors and your composing endeavors and whatever musical projects you have going on right now. How can our listeners find out more about you? I mean, do you have a website or a place you direct people? Like, what's Greg up to these days?
Yeah. I do have a website. It's wilburmusic.com. WILBUR music.com. And that's where I post, well, if I actually post, but that's where news about music or new releases and things like that. And also sheet music and choral music and other connecting points there.
Okay. And
New College Franklin.edu.
For your other endeavors. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us here on Dwell. We wish you the best, and here's to home.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.